He won a number of seats in a regional parliamentary election in Andalusia, the first successful election for the far right in Spain since the country returned to democracy in the 1970s after the death of military dictator Francisco Franco. Former Donald Trump advisor Steve Bannon threw his support behind Vox earlier this year and has apparently been advising the far-right party. Vox campaigned on an anti-immigrant, anti-abortion platform, and many observers are worried about the rise of far-right political populism in Spain.
Brazil's Fernando Haddad, the former 2018 presidential candidate of the Workers' Party, has been invited to join an international progressive movement fronted by United States left-leaning politician Bernie Sanders and former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis. The initiative, announced in October, is set to combat the rise of an, quote, authoritarian axis and, quote, the movement, a far-right nationalist front with an international reach. Quote, all around the world, in Europe, in Russia, in the Middle East, in Asia and elsewhere, we are seeing movements led by demagogues who exploit people's fears, prejudices and grievances to achieve and hold on to power, Sanders said in an article for The Guardian. The far-right threat, the movement, has been gaining publicity since Steve Bannon, former White House chief strategist for the Trump administration, joined ranks. Progressives International aim is to challenge the hostile ideals within the rise of far-right politics that are gaining ground across the globe.
The Yemeni
If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
What happened to ending the war in Afghanistan? We have troops protecting borders all over the world, not our own border. But the most important point
is moving the military to the border. I mean, he can't do anything else. He has indicated he's going to close the whole southern border. No president. I mean, they've sent the military to the border. Bush did and Obama did. But I've never seen anything as focused as we are right now. Who do you think sending these people?
Well, his rhetoric is great. There are troops, I think 5,000 on the border, but if you are an aficionado of the Andy Griffith Show, Barney Fife could have a gun, but only one bullet, and that bullet he had to keep in his pocket because he wasn't a very good shot. That's more bullets than our troops on the border have.
Well, they're not allowed to use them because
Trump is.
You know what the legal requirement is, posse comitatus. I mean, he is doing everything he can to back it up. What?
Number one, you can't shoot Americans. You can shoot invaders. Number two, even if that were true, okay, go 1 yard into Mexico. What's happening on our border is certainly a bigger crisis for Americans than Grenada was.
We can't invade Mexico to stop them from coming in here. I mean, we're doing the same thing unless Mexico gives us that authority. If you recall, even in Benghazi, they said, well, we didn't get permission from Libya to go in and protect our men. We certainly can't cross the border to shoot them up over there. I mean, if that's what you're talking about, to send the military there.
We invaded, Reagan invaded Grenada, and Grenada was far less of a threat to Americans than what's happening on our border. And I'm saying, I don't think the Posse Comitatus Act, I mean, Nazis have been arrested by our troops when they landed in the Hamptons, no less.
Right,
with guns.
Our troops had guns.
He's the commander-in-chief. This is what he should be doing.
And he's got to follow the law because there are federal judges all over this country who will stop him in his tracks. Final word, Ann, real fast.
I don't think so. I don't think so. Well, most of the property in Texas.
All right.
So they'll bring a lawsuit, but they'll lose.
Yeah, ultimately.
And that's not a reason not to try it.
Well, you know what? The Ninth Circuit is...
There's no tomorrow on this.
Yep. Well, let's
this
hope
omnibus
not.
Bill Ann is the last chance.
All right, Ann Coulter. Thanks so much for being with us tonight.
On the Indian Radio. You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man mean you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you see? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all one land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for the smart of the region.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Inteligente de Indigena.
I started this gang called the Proud Boys. And,
the Proud Boys?
The Proud Boys.
What's Proud Boys about?
We will kill you. That's the Proud Boys in a nutshell. We will kill you. We look nice. We seem soft. We have boys in our name. But like Bill the Butcher and the Bowery Boys, we will assassinate you. Now, part of the reason I agree to do the talk is because I'm allowed to bring all my guys. And we can fight our way in and fight our way out.
I think it's our job to do it. And the cops just turn a blind eye.
Trust your instincts. Don't listen to what he has to say. Choke him. If I do a video where I say, how about we start throwing bricks? Is that legal? You can't call for violence on a specific person, but can you say they're throwing bricks? We should throw bricks. Can you call for violence generally? Because I am.
Fighting solves everything. We need more violence from the Trump people. Trump supporters, choke a mother... Choke a bitch. Choke a tranny. Get your fingers around the windpipe.
I want violence. I want punching in the face. I'm disappointed in Trump supporters for not punching enough.
Get a gun.
Get ready to blow someone's head off. I've even killed people in my dreams. That's how awesome my gun is.
Get in trouble. Get arrested. Get fired. Let's all get in this together. They can't kill us all.
This is Nolan Hack, black activist from the city of Los Angeles, California. You are listening to the Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, and this is a wonderful show, and you should always tune in.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
Internet radio for smart
aboriginals. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America. This is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salaton and peace to all original human beings resident on the physical plane. I'm your host, the Angry Indian. editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com, as well as our main news portal, ang-newswire.blogspot.com. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in unceded Chinook and Peoples Territories, North America. Yeah, I know. I get tired of saying it, you get tired of hearing about it, but we do apologize for the delay. Let's press on. I mean, a lot of the delay, but besides the fact that life gets in the goddamn way, you know, a lot of the fucking delay, I don't know what to say. I really don't know what the fuck to say to you, brothers and sisters. I don't. I really fucking don't. Things are not looking goddamn good, okay? Politically speaking, for everybody around the fucking planet, everybody around the bubble, you know, it's not looking fucking good for anybody. And even with that, I don't know where to even goddamn begin. You know, I mean, do you want to talk about Yemen? Right? Do you want to talk about the Rohingya? Do you want to talk about the caravan that is supposedly being funded? If you listen to Vice President, U.S. Vice President, Mike Pence, this caravan is coming up here being funded by leftist groups. George Soros was thrown out there, right? And Venezuela, you know, which doesn't have any money to do any goddamn thing. They're trying to stay afloat. You know, they're so busy trying to stay afloat at this point that they're not talking to Russia. I mean, well, they were always talking to Russia anyway, but I mean, now they're really talking to Russia. And of course, Russia's just laughing at every goddamn buddy. Did you see that high five between Putin and, you know, Ms. Angry Indian thinks this shit is hysterical. Lupe is just like, you know, don't you get how dangerous this is? You know, because, your husband's political, my spouse is not political, and she doesn't get the ramifications of this. I mean, Putin and fucking, I mean, they got it down to an MBS. I mean, that's the one thing that she's laughing about, that they got an acronym for this motherfucker, Mohammed bin Salman, right? Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. That he and Putin are high-fiving each other and laughing and giggling like goddamn schoolboys who just pulled a prank on somebody. Because that's what happened, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, and other lurkers. They did pull a prank on us. They gave us fucking Trump, and now we're stuck with what the fuck we're stuck with. Ask everybody in Ukraine. I mean, Ukraine, I still don't even know how to fathom that situation. You know, they were flying Confederate flags down there. But then at the same time, you had IDF Israelis who were going over there and helping the far right in Ukraine organize. I'm still not sure where Poroshenko, is that how you pronounce his name? Luke? Poroshenko, because I know who I'm talking about. Because, you know, he was involved in that poisoning. In this case, the fella didn't die, right? But he was poisoned. I can't keep up. I can't keep up. I don't know what to look at. I don't know what to look at first. I don't know what to look at next. I can't keep up. You know, and now there's a group. Now, you know, full disclosure, we report their stuff on Mohawk Nation News. You know, we've been dealing with them for quite some time. I suppose unless things have changed, you know, I mean, they're still dealing with Brendan O'Rell. She's out there deep in Indian country, you know, reporting on what's happening, you know, over there. And you should visit her site, because I think she's reporting on stories that are totally underreported, and they should be looked at. You know, go over there. But at the same time, Mohawk Nation News, I mean, we reposted this. Lou, you know, sometime this afternoon. I forgot when. I forgot when. I don't know. Oh, but when it would, it doesn't matter. But you know, it's up there. Where, I guess there's a group of Mohawks, up in Great White North of Occupy Canada, who have decided that they want to talk to the Russian government. Why? I have no fucking idea. How would that benefit them? You know, it's not. You know, if the Russian government is going to do anything, it's going to do it for the goddamn selves. I mean, the Russian government doesn't treat indigenous people in Russia very fucking well. So it's like, why would they think that they're going to treat the Mohawks any fucking better? I don't get this. But this is the same kind of development in this type of environment that I've seen, where you had First Nations leaders in the Great White North of Occupy Canada who went on Press TV. Now, I'm not knocking that. I mean, you know, Press TV is the state, is the Iranian government's national state television, right? Now, it is a news service. And then, you know, if you really want to get into this a little further, you know, fucking dumbass Trump, this son of a bitch. You know, I mean, I don't get him. I don't get him. I don't get his logic other than to really acknowledge that none of it is goddamn logical. Not an iota of it. I mean, he at one point was talking about he's going to, you know, underfund or cut out or do whatever he can to get rid of all of these fake news outlets in the United States, you know, except for Fox, right? You know, he likes Fox, but he's going to get rid of everybody else. And he's going to come up with an American, you know, news service and what have you, right? I mean, I guess he's never heard of Voice of Goddamn America, you know. I suppose he's never heard of Radio Free Europe. I suppose he's never heard of Radio Mati. I suppose he's never heard of Radio Free whatever the fuck, you know. I mean, all of that bullshit is U.S. government funded, you know, whether it's through CIA or goddamn the State Department, you know, whoever the fuck it is, man, whoever's running it, right? You know, whatever propaganda, you know, armed U.S. Army probably, you know, whoever the fuck at the time. You know, ask Edward Snowden. He's in Russia. He should know. You know, was he working for them beforehand? I have no fucking idea. But he certainly made a deal. He had to give them something, but he wouldn't fucking be there. He went to China first, didn't he? And of course, China and Russia have their own relationship. They're neighbors. They got a history. And they don't give a fuck about the West, really. It, you know, for all the kinds of purposes, you know, the rest is a competitor. It's a pain in the ass on the other side of the motherfucking world. You know, they don't give a goddamn about what happens over here to anybody. I mean, you know, they sell their own motherfucking people over there in mainland China. And yeah, I know, I can't go to China, right, anymore. After this, but I've already said shit about China and Thailand and fucking Burma / Myanmar and a bunch of other goddamn countries who do all kinds of wrong shit. So it really doesn't motherfucking matter. But you know, in the case of China, you know, it's a goddamn documented fucking fact through their own fucking court news system. Because I actually do read the Chinese motherfucking news. I read news from all over the fucking world. Okay. You know, and I suggest that you do the same goddamn thing. Get yourself an RSS reader so you can read news feeds. And if you are an old timer and you still want to do list service, you know, go right ahead. But, you know, get all your news in one goddamn application so you don't have to go all over the fucking place except to, you know, do your cross checks. And I read the Chinese news. And what you find in the Chinese national news are cases of business owners, distributors, who are replacing what should be pork in buns with cardboard. They flavor the cardboard with a whole lot of hoisin sauce. Is that what I want to say? You know, and they just go ahead and bake it up with the rest of the dough and whatever the fuck else they're putting in the dough. You know, I mean, a lot of the honey coming out of China is not honey. You know, one shop owner, the last time I was in Seattle, because I haven't bought anything here. Have you? I don't know. Just haven't had a use for it. Not lately, anyway. But anyway, you know, that he told me flat out, because I knew this guy. You know, he's Chinese, and his family owned a supermarket over there in South Goddamn Seattle. And motherfucking, he said, yeah, man, that they've had the same cases of soy sauce back, because they got notifications that the soy sauce was not really fucking soy sauce, that, you know, it was food coloring and whatever the fuck else they put into it. I mean, this is like I've mentioned recently about, you know, La Cosa Nostra, or the, you know, any of the organized crime families or groups in Sicily and Sardinia, you know, whatever the fuck, right? In Italy. I mean, olive oil is one of the biggest goddamn scams going. You know, and if you're not, you know, somebody who really uses olive oil, if it's not a cultural thing for you especially, you're not really thinking about this. But olive oil is important to a lot of people. And, you know, it's like rice. It's one of those universal things for a lot of different, not just cuisines, but a lot of different cultures. It's part of some religious practices, to be honest with you. You know, especially if you're in Greece or in Cyprus. And I just mentioned Sardinia, right? You know, you still have people practicing really old traditions that they've mixed with Catholicism. Anyway, that's not what I wanted to talk about. But you know, what I'm saying is that the mafia, I don't know. When you say mafia, I guess you're talking about what happened here in the United States, right? Not what I'm talking about, the crime family. Anyway, you know what I'm talking about. Organized crime, right? So, these cats, man, you know, but I mean, they're not just out there, you know, prostitution and protection money, you know. No. They're also scamming, you know, bogus, fucking olive oil, bogus, motor fuel. You know, petrol, man. I mean, fake petrol. There are truckers where they're driving around with like 60, 40, 70, 30 mixtures of gasoline and these fake goddamn additives that are fucking up their engines. You know, I mean, it's incredible how much, what is it? All right, Lupe say I'm exaggerating that. So what are the real numbers then? She says that she's saying that I'm exaggerating the numbers on this a bit, but that it is pretty bad, yeah. Yeah, but it is leading to engine trouble in a lot of poorer communities, right? Where this stuff gets unloaded, yeah, so. Okay. She's correcting me here. Okay, it's not, even though it happens with motor cars, trucking, what have you, she's saying that it's mostly with housing fuel that this is happening. And, you know, it damages the components for the, for home heating. So is that the percentages that I was in? Okay, can we just keep talking about this shit? Alright, look, man. Look. You know, we got a lot of fucking problems out here. And, you know, I'm really upset. And I'm upset because the fucking left has not gotten this shit together at all. And the evidence of this is the fucking fact that the far right is winning seats every fucking way you look. Everywhere they're goddamn running. You know, and now, Spain, right? I'm finding out here through, when I first saw it was democracynow.org, which I suggest you go look. Goddamn, man. I mean, how the fuck is this happening in 2018? But see, that's the problem. It can happen in 2018 because so many motherfucking young people don't remember what the fuck happened beforehand. Now, it's not entirely their motherfucking fault, but see, the bottom line is, and this is where I blame the fucking left, and this is where I blame post-structural, post-modernist, in some cases, bullshit. You know, to me anyway, it's balance. You know, like we got a lot of people here in Oregon, they're into this, unstructured child raising. You know, which is fine if you live in a fucking small community and you never intend to leave that motherfucker. So, I mean, if you live in the Dalles or some shit, or you live up there where they had the fucking crazy-ass Bundy family and their followers take over a goddamn entire federal fucking reserve up here in the Malheur and shit reservation, you know, where they destroyed and literally pissed and shat on Native American goddamn artifacts from the people of that fucking region up there, man. Yo, no apologies, no nothing. These fuckers are out. These fuckers are out. They're heroes now. They're heroes now. You know, one of them, Jerry DeLemus, the only reason why they're holding him is because he was part of a previous action in which I guess some of them are still trying are still being tried for. Is that what it is? You need to follow JJ McNabb. If that's, I don't know what her Twitter handle is, but she's on Twitter. She follows this shit, a lot closer. I mean, we follow it close, but I mean, she's actually following it close, you know, and you need to check it out. But in any case, you know, a lot of them have been let go, like David Fry, the motherfucking computer fucker, you know, the hacker, fucker. I mean, they literally urinated and defecated on Native American fucking artifacts to prove a point. They then went so far as to do exactly what the fuck Jerry DeLemus was doing in Nevada when they, you know, because the Bundy family wants to graze. They want to graze their cattle, their cattlemen, they want to graze, but they don't want to pay any of the fucking federal fees for grazing on federal land. Now, you got to pay your motherfucking taxes. Trump doesn't pay taxes. Trump doesn't do any motherfucking thing he's supposed to. He doesn't represent this country in any goddamn way, shape, or form with any kind of motherfucking honor. And, yeah, you know, you're responsible for your bullshit, but see, these particular white men who are into the Kleinskousen version of Mormonism don't believe they need to pay taxes to motherfucking anybody. Now, you know, I've been very clear. You know, the left needs to get its motherfucking act the fuck together. Get it together. I'm telling you motherfuckers, you know, up here in North America, man. You know, the American left, in Canada too, your motherfuckers is on notice, man. Your motherfuckers are on notice, man. I'm telling you, man. Y'all on notice. You're not motherfucking fighting this shit the way you're fucking supposed to. You're not fucking doing it. Okay? Here's the goddamn problem. A lot of this bullshit, and I just fucking finished talking about unstructured goddamn child rearing. Now, I get the idea of, you know, allow your, you know, youth to be free, allow young people to express themselves, yada, yada, yada. You don't have to convince me of any of this. But, you know, I think I said it was the last broadcast, and I know I've been saying it over time, you know, on this broadcast and in private conversations. I'm starting to lean towards school uniforms again. I really am. And you know, the idea is not to remove a person's individuality, but that there's a time and a place for every goddamn thing. You know, there's a time for decorum. There's a time for letting loose. There's a time and a place for every motherfucking thing. And a lot of y'all motherfuckers don't know the whys or the wheres or the hows or the whatnots, man. And it's totally, you know, politically, it's fucking things up across the goddamn world. You know, you gotta understand something. You know, I had to explain this shit to a group of people last night, and it's really ridiculous. I have to say shit to people in their fucking 40s and 50s and goddamn, late 30s. You know, 60s and shit, that you guys have been around long enough and you can be really fucking critical and nitpick about shit, but you're not paying attention. A lot of this fucking freedom thing, you know, you let the fucking far right co-opt every fucking thing. I mean, you know, Gavin McGinnis, who's been out here promising violence and demanding that the Trump administration perpetuate violence and that the GOP, you know, demand violence. He's on record for doing this. You know, he spoke to Joe Rogan, who not too long ago was smoking a joint with goddamn Alex Jones, right? You know, about how he's all about violence and about wading in the crowds and starting shit and getting in the fucking fist fights because they got some Victorian, antiquated, you know, that they're going to bring it all back for white men if they get down to the essence of what makes a white man a white man. So, you know, in a lot of ways, you can go back in socialism and find this with Jack London. Jack London was a socialist. He was part of the left fucking wing. Okay? But at the same goddamn time, I mean, he was sympathetic towards the poor. He was sympathetic towards this, that, and the other. But at the same time, he was a rabid motherfucking racist. And was totally, you know, okay with racism. I mean, well, not so much racism, but with racial violence being perpetuated against black people in the sense that, he was supportive of it as long as it defended white male interests. Now, there are a lot of people that are going to say I'm reading too much into this, but you need to actually look at the life and work of Jack London and his articles. Not just his books and his short stories. I'm talking about his newspaper articles, especially around the Jack Johnson fight, you know, the type of fucking racism that he was pushing during that shit. Now, on top of that, here come the contradictions. The contradictions is that one of the closest people to him in his, for his entire fucking life was this goddamn black nanny. Or really, I should say, his mammy. Okay? The black tit that fucking nursed him. You understand what I'm saying? He took care of this woman for the rest of her motherfucking life. He loved her as an individual, but he hated black people as a fucking whole. You know, I've known plenty of goddamn white men who have had Asian wives, black wives, right? Native American wives, and were racist as fucking hell. Even against the fucking group in which that they were married to one of their members. And they could always justify their fucking racism with some bullshit. And really what it came down to, especially when I was younger, it's like, okay, so technically this is just this piece of ass, right? But, you know, really, it's like, no, I made exception for her. The rest of these people are motherfucking, you know, whatever. Now, how did I come to that realization? Because it happened to me several goddamn times. And I'm not talking about that bullshit you hear, you know, swirling, whatever the fuck, because that's an epithet. What I'm saying is, you know, I was out there. I'm mixed. I was out there. But then, you know, I'm still not white. Might not be black, but I'm not white, right? And, you know, you're in that motherfucking middle ground. And it's like, if you're not white, you're nothing. Really. You're nothing. So there would be plenty of people that would say, you know, I'm an exception. You know, which really hurts after you fucked. You dig what I'm saying? You know, and it's like, you know, you've just been intimate and shit, especially if you already got feelings for this individual and you're thinking, okay, well, maybe they're different, you know, and, you know, this is a white woman or an Asian chick or whatever the fuck that, you know, is willing to go through whatever bullshit with you. And then to have to hear, well, you know, you're exceptional. But you come from a fucking race of backward people, you know. I mean, however the fuck they articulate it. You know, this shit really happens, man. This shit really happens. I mean, how many motherfucking black women went on YouTube, you know, with audio and video of their white husbands and boyfriends flipping out, talking about jumping up and down, talking about, you know, we're going to put these niggas in their place. You don't want to be in this country. Get the fuck out. How many Latina women found out just how motherfucking racist their partner was? After they got mortgages and children and everything else going on, to find out that, oh, wow. You know, now that, you know, Trump is in and racism is okay, I'm divorcing my husband. I'm not fucking joking. I'm not, there have been relationships that have broken up because of this election. You know, now the same thing happened when Obama got in, you know. You know, a lot of the racism came out in people and folks were like, you know, I can't believe I'm married to you. I'm not kidding about that. Friendships have brought, I mean, I've lost a couple of friendships about this shit because, you know, they started telling me how the fuck they really felt. You know, some people have a cocktail, they have a few beers and shit and, you know, they've had a dance and they'll tell you how the fuck they really feel, man. You know, especially when they've done a line of goddamn two, they'll tell you what the fuck they're thinking. Yeah. They'll tell you what the fuck they've been thinking about you for the past 11, 12 years. Yeah. Hell yeah. So, yeah, there was all kinds of shit I was going to talk about, man, but, you know, fuck it. I'm done. We're going to put on some educational audio here, but, you know, on the whole, the left needs to wake the fuck up. Some of the bullshit that is happening is the fault of the, and what I mean by that is,
is that, you know, not what the fucking right is talking about, because they're liars and crooks and cheats, and they make exceptions for their own fucking immorality and their criminality. I mean, George Papadopoulos just got out the goddamn fucking federal joint the other goddamn day. And then you got Michael Cohen there. You got Michael Flynn here making fucking deals. You got Roger Stone out there. How many motherfuckers have already pled guilty? Or already fucking, you know, trying to cop to lesser fucking pleas and shit. So, you know, I mean, he's already lied about the goddamn, well, I don't have any business in Russia. That's a motherfucking lie. You know? So, yeah, I mean, you know, what can I really say that you don't already know on that front? It's all bullshit. I mean, this new chick that he's going to send, you know, Nikki Haley, who can insult Native Americans and get away with it, apparently, because Native Americans are more worried about whether or not, you know, Elizabeth Warren is really Cherokee and shit, because that's really the number one fucking thing pressing on Native people right now, when water and electricity and fucking internet and phone service and housing, basic fucking housing and education are issues. Clothing and bullshit are issues. But no, we're going to continue to rag on that. But yes, you know, she's left now. She's not going to be over there at the UN, you know, lying for the Trump administration anymore. She decided to get out early, right? Like General John Kelly, you know, the chief of staff is leaving early, right? So motherfucking, they're going to replace her with Christine Newart. Is that her name, Luke? Whatever the fuck her name is. She's this blonde chick. And, you know, she's going to be the new eye candy popsicle for these motherfuckers. And they're going to send her over there. And she's going to do her thing. And, you know, it's going to be what it is, right? It's going to be the usual fucking thing. I mean, remember Dana Perino? You know, Dana Perino somehow didn't understand what the fuck happened in Pearl Harbor, right? And according to Newart, Germany and the United States were on the same side during World War II. So you make of this what the fuck you will, ladies and gentlemen. You make of this what the fuck you will, because, you know, I, at this point, again, I'm at a loss for words. So this is the Angry Indian, and you've been listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Please, as we go out here, take a station break, so the stations may identify themselves. Please stay tuned.
Also for blacks and other minorities, and they have done a lot on the problems in Palestine and also the problems of blacks, and so I recommend that you listen to them.
This video is a message to all the fake liberals and fake progressives out there. The next thing I would normally say here is, you know who you are. But chances are you don't. Chances are, if you're a fake liberal, you think I'm talking about someone else. You probably think of yourself to be the real McCoy. I aim to rectify that misunderstanding shortly. There was a time when I thought liberals were my allies. They spoke out against the wars, against the Patriot Act, the secret prisons, the tortures, the growing defense budget, and the blatant fascism when Bush was in office. And for 8 years, I listened to liberal talk show hosts and other so-called activists, believing them at face value. When Obama came along, I understood people's enthusiasm. He was saying all the right things, at least from that illusory view of the left. But when I started looking into who was funding him and backing him, and began pointing this out to people, the response I got was less than receptive. No problem, I thought. If he's really a corporate puppet like the evidence indicates, then the left will wake up quickly and the push towards real change will continue. That's where I was dead wrong. You see, what I was about to discover is that being a liberal or conservative in America is much like being a member of a religion. And like the Catholic Church, which covers up the molestation of young boys committed by their priest, most conservatives and liberals are much more concerned about protecting their position than they are about the truth. This is the herd mentality. Self-identify with the herd, defend the leader of the herd regardless of what he does, acknowledge nothing that might damage the image of the herd, and above all, never step outside of the pack. If this means discarding all or most of the values that one had proclaimed just a few months prior, so be it. I had come to believe that values like standing against injustice, war, torture, assassinations, domestic spying, and corruption were liberal values. But I was wrong. These were just catchphrases, political mud pies to be thrown at the opposition. They were never real principles intended to stand above party alliances. In the beginning of the Obama presidency, I could excuse the lingering stars in the eyes, the lack of awareness of the early warning signs. A lot of people didn't even notice that Obama kept Bush's defense secretary, Robert Gates, or that he named former Raytheon lobbyist William Lynn to be his deputy defense secretary. But now, with 4 years of warmongering and blatant corruption under his belt, his obscene bailouts of Wall Street, the top campaign contributor Goldman Sachs in particular, signing off on the largest defense budget in American history and therefore world history, the expanded drone program in multiple countries, the continued use of secret prisons and torture, and the continued use of executive orders to move America closer and closer to being an outright military dictatorship, at this point, those who defend Obama have no excuse anymore. I find it funny that when I point these things out, these fake liberals like to come back with what they think is a clever defense, which is essentially to point the finger at Bush and say that Bush started it. Bush started it? That's the best you can do? What I find even more funny is that they throw this in my face as if I would find it shocking or offensive. Never does it seem to cross their mind that they might just be talking to someone who actually cares about the morality of the issues regardless of which team did what. Never does it cross their mind that they might be speaking to someone who was speaking out against the wars during the Bush administration too, and who actually expected the same standards to be applied to the Obama administration. Never does it cross their mind that they might be talking to someone who doesn't buy into the left-right herd mentality. Obama supporters pointing the finger at Bush is about as valid as Stalin pointing the finger at Hitler saying that he started the mass murders first. That's not an exaggeration. These wars of aggression are mass murder. Here's the deal. If you don't actually care about the issues that you brought up during the Bush administration, if you just pretended to be anti-war when it was trendy and cool, if your moral compass swings as needed to protect the Democratic Party, then you are a fake liberal. You are no better than the idiots that still supported Bush at the end of his last term, and you deserve nothing but utter disdain. Obama's regime apologists are the new neocons. They've taken the religion of preemptive war, covert destabilization, and corporate fascism and given it a new paint job. But I got news for you. You're not fooling anybody but yourselves. So am I talking to you? If you're starting to feel angry and defensive right now, then yes, I'm talking to you. There's no point directing that anger towards me or anyone else. You have no one to blame but yourself for your hypocrisy. And there's no point trying to defend yourself either, because there is no defense. The only thing that you could possibly do to regain your credibility is to change your behavior. But what you need to realize is that if you don't change now, if you wait until Obama is out of office, then no one is going to take you seriously for the next 8 years of Republican rule that's going to follow. The next time you see one of these guys defending Obama, send them a link to this video. It's time to make these morons embarrassed to show their faces. Agree or disagree, leave your 2 cents in the comments. And if that's not enough, call us tonight, Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern, and we can discuss any topic you'd like. Want more like this? Don't forget to subscribe. And if you want to make sure you don't miss any videos, then follow us on Facebook and Twitter and my personal website, stormcloudsgathering.com, for bonus content.
I'm not sure I can trust you. Really, he's right. I gotta say that. I can only go by what I see. This Uncle Tom says you're his buddy. So what kind of witness does that make you for me?
It's to France now, where President Emmanuel Macron has climbed down from his unpopular increase in the fuel tax. It came after 3 weeks of growing protests by the so-called Yellow Vests, named after the highly visible jackets that they have become known and has been their symbol and uniform. In a televised address, he announced tax hikes would be suspended until next summer, but the move has done little to appease the protesters.
A French school going up in flames. These images were filmed in Toulouse, but other images spread on social media showed similar scenes elsewhere. High school students on strike for the second day. The students say they want to voice their opposition to education reforms and show support for the Yellow Vest protests. Meanwhile, on national TV, the French Prime Minister announced the government was suspending planned increases to fuel taxes for 6 months in response to the nationwide protests.
This anger has deep roots. It's been brewing for a long time.
It often stayed quiet out of discretion or pride. Today it is being expressed with force and in a collective way. One has to be deaf or blind not to see or hear it.
But there was also a clear warning. The government would not tolerate further violence from the yellow vests.
If another day of protest is organized on Saturday, it must be authorized and must take place peacefully. The Interior Minister will use all necessary means to enforce law and order.
Sparked by an announced fuel tax hike, the yellow vest protests have now come to reflect more widespread anger at the government. They've hit major cities, causing damage and disruption over the last 3 weeks. The government move is an attempt to quell this unrest. But yellow vest supporters say it's too little, too late.
It's not a sign of appeasement, it's just a stalling tactic. There's nothing there, it's empty, there's no specific explanation. I don't think that's going to be enough to put this genie back into its bottle, because now it's out, and people are waiting for something else as an answer.
The climb down is yet another setback for President Emmanuel Macron. His approval ratings have slipped sharply in recent months, and it's doubtful this policy U-turn will appease the protesters.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Please note, if you experience difficulty with a cassette, please hold it flat in the palm of your hand and slap it smartly against a hard, flat surface. If this does not work, call the customer service number shown on the package for a replacement. Discard the broken cassette.
Paul Stamets, Mushrooms and Saving the World.
We are so blind. Many of these mushrooms are so perishable, they disappear in 5 days. When you have mushrooms that can feed you, that can kill you, that can make you high, that can heal you, and it's only in your visual viewscape for a few days, it's naturally for humans to avoid that which is powerful but mysterious to them.
On the next broadcast of TUC Radio.
He made a legend out of Nigger Charlie. He made a hit out of Hammer. Now, Fred Williamson is back as Black Caesar. Black Caesar. He carved out a name for himself in the blood of his enemies. Hail Caesar, godfather of Harlem.
It's a jungle. It takes a jungle bunny to run it.
Black Caesar.
Get down!
Music composed and performed by James Brown.
Bandit calls to be the boss.
Fred Williamson is Black Caesar. From American International, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent. This Caesar comes to bury you.
Anarchism is not bombs, disorder, or chaos. It is not robbery and murder. It is not a war of each against all.
Tune in to Subversion 1312, the 4ZZZ Anarchy Show.
Tuesday from 9 till 10 p.m. on 102.1 FM or streaming 4ZZZFM.org.au.
How about trying this future on for size?
Hello, this is Susan Aglukak. The first week of December is Aboriginal AIDS Awareness Week. Learn the ways you can protect yourself and others from infection and spreading HIV. Together can make a difference.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCopFire.
I am absolutely convinced that this nation is finally headed in the right direction. Our economy is growing again. We are adding jobs again. America's moving forward again.
President Obama wants $50 billion to create jobs for construction of roads, railways, and runways. Already, billions have been committed in new initiatives such as Social Innovation Fund, economic stimulus, and broadband. And hundreds of millions are going to border security. Yet, security and jobs for whom? Construction jobs mostly employ men. The new funding initiatives have principally benefited institutions and government. And border security seems to be for U.S. transnationals operating maquilas and those seeking to profit from the violence and poverty in Ciudad Juarez and Mexico. But what about security and jobs for women workers on the U.S.-Mexico border? Why invest in infrastructure benefiting transnational corporations and not in community-led development? For nearly two decades, first with NAFTA and now with the war on drugs, border women have seen their livelihoods, communities, and futures written off as unfortunate but necessary casualties by the companies they made rich, left to live and die amidst the underdevelopment of the border. Yet, women have refused to accept this fate. Organized, fierce, and resilient, they're pursuing their own version of security and employment. La Mujer Obrera in El Paso is one example. Through their daycare, restaurant, festival marketplace, museum, media center, and adult education programs, the women are creating genuine border security, real economic development. And they have extensive plans for additional development, including schools, housing, and health programs. Like La Mujer Obrera, there are other low-income women on the border who have the vision and drive needed to create spaces where cultural arts and grassroots microenterprises can flourish, restoring economy, pride, and dignity in their neighborhoods. Their efforts are the stuff that economists, feminists, and reformers tout as vital to build sustainable national security and development. Yet today, the women find themselves fighting their hardest battle yet, sustainability in the weakest U.S. economy in decades, and a future being designed without them. Local and national media have focused on border violence and security issues, but have missed the solutions that border women are ready to implement. Public-private initiatives need to prioritize border women's efforts to restore their communities from the damaging effects of international trade policies. As Gloria Steinem said when she visited La Mujer Obrera, there is no safe space for women. We have to create that space. We have to build that community. The conditions of women on the border are urgent, and women on the border are demanding justice and equity now. For more information, contact La Mujer Obrera.
In the Protestant religion, we are taught that when a person dies, you should celebrate their death because they are leaving a sinful world. Woman slaughter. It doesn't hurt as much now. The thought of you dead doesn't rip at my innards, leaves no holes to suck rage. Now thoughts of the four daughters of Buster Cooks, children, survivors of Texas hell, survivors of soul-searing poverty, survivors of small-town mentality, survivors, now three, doesn't hurt as much now. One, an act. I used to be fearful of phone calls in the night, never in the day. Death, like the vampire, fears the sun, never in the day. Hello, Patty? Hey, big sister, what's happening? How's the kids? Patty, Jonesy shot Shirley. She didn't make it. Hello, hello, death. Don't you know it's daytime? The sun is much too bright today. Hello, hello, death. You made a mistake. Came here too soon again. 5 months, death. My sisters and I just met in celebration of you. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and buried him. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and took care of his widow. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and shook hands with his friends. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, and picked the ripe flowers. We came, the four strong daughters of Buster Cooks, walked tall and celebrated you. We came, his four strong daughters, and notified insurance companies, arranged Social Security payments, gathered the sum of his life. We must be strong for Mother. She was the third daughter of Buster Cooks. I am the fourth, and in his death we met. The 4 years that separated us, gone, and we talked. She would divorce the quiet man, go back to school, begin again. Together we would be strong and take care of Buster's widow. The poet returned to the family. The fourth daughter came home. Hello, hello, death. What's this you say to me? Now there are three? We came, the three sisters of Shirley Jones, and took care of her mother. We picked the right flowers, contacted insurance companies, arranged Social Security payments, and cremated her. We came, the three sisters of Shirley Jones. We were not strong. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. 2. Justice. There was a quiet man. He married a quiet wife. Together they lived a quiet life. Not so, not so, her sisters said. The truth comes out as she lies dead. He beat her. He accused her of awful things, and he beat her. One day she left. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. She went to her sister's house. She, too, was a woman alone. The quiet man came and beat her. Both women were afraid. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. The four strong daughters of Buster Cooks came to bury him. The third one carried a gun. Why do you have a gun? For protection, just in case. Can you shoot it? Yes, I have learned well. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman alone, and I am afraid. My husband means to kill me. Lady, there's nothing we can do until he tries to hurt you. Go to the judge, and he will decree that your husband leaves you be. She found an apartment with a friend. She would begin a new life again. In a lockery, divorce degree in hand, the end of the quiet man. He came to her home. And he beat her. Both women were afraid. Hello, hello, police. I am a woman alone, and I am afraid. My ex-husband means to kill me. Fear not, lady. He will be sought. It was too late when he was caught. One day, a quiet man shot his quiet wife 3 times in the back. He shot her friend as well. His wife died. The three sisters of Shirley Jones came to cremate her. They were not strong. 3. Somebody's trial. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. I was not at the trial. I was not needed to testify. She slept with other men, he said. No, said her friends. No, said her sisters. That is a lie. She was black. You are white. Why were you there? We were friends, she said. I was helping her move the furniture. The divorce court had given it to her. Were you alone, they asked? No, 2 men came with us. They were gone with a load. She slept with women, he said. No, said her sisters. No, said her friends. We were only friends. That is a lie. You live with this woman? Yes, said her friend. You slept in the same bed? Yes, said her friend. Were you lovers? No, said her friend. But you slept in the same bed? Yes, said her friend. What shall be done with this man? Is it a murder of first degree? No, said the men. It is a crime of passion. He was angry. Is it a murder of second degree? Yes, said the men. But we will not call it that. We must think of his record. We will call it manslaughter. The sentence is the same. What will we do with this man? His boss, a white man, came. This is a quiet black man, he said. He works well for me. The men sent the quiet black man to jail. He went to work in the day, he went to jail and slept at night. In 1 year, he went home. 4. Woman slaughter. It is good, they said, that Buster is dead. He would surely kill the quiet man. Sister, I do not understand. I rage and do not understand. In Texas, he would be freed. One black kills another, one less black for Texas. But this is not Texas. This is California, the city of angels. Was his crime so slight? George Jackson served years for robbery. Eldridge Cleaver served years for rape. I know of a man in Texas who is serving 40 years for possession of marijuana. Was his crime so slight? What was his crime? He only killed his wife, but a divorce, I say, not final, they say. Her things were his, including her life. Men cannot rape their wives. Men cannot kill their wives. They passion them to death. The three sisters of Shirley Jones came and cremated her, and they were not strong. Hear me now. It is almost 3 years, and I am again strong. I have gained many sisters, and if one is beaten or raped or killed, I will not come in mourning black. I will not pick the right flowers. I will not celebrate her death. And it will matter not if she's black or white, if she loves women or men. I will come with my many sisters and decorate the streets with the innards of those brothers in woman slaughter. No more can I dull my rage in alcohol and deference to men's courts. I will come to my sisters, not dutiful. I will come strong.
Niggas are scared all of niggas. Revolution.
Niggas.
But niggas shouldn't be scared of revolution.
All niggas.
Because
niggas.
Revolution is nothing but change. And all niggas do
all
is change. Niggas come in for murder and change into pimping clothes. The industries to make
niggas.
Some quick change. Niggas change their
niggas.
Hair from black
all
to red
niggas.
To blind.
Niggas.
And old black hair and lips will change. Niggas kill other
niggas
just because one
niggas.
Didn't receive the
niggas.
Correct change. Niggas change from men
niggas.
To women, from women
niggas.
To men. Niggas change, change, change.
Change.
You hear niggas say, things are changing, things are changing. Yeah, things are changing. Nigga things into black nigga things. Black nigga things that go through all kinds of changes. The change in the day that makes you mad and rave. Black power, and the change that comes over them at night as they sigh and moan. Light thighs, ooh, light thighs. Niggas always going through bullshit change. But when it comes for real change, niggas are scared of revolution.
The injustice that has been inflicted upon Negroes in this country by Uncle Sam is criminal.
Niggas are actors. Niggas are actors. Niggas act like they're in a hurry to catch the first act of the great white hope. Niggas try to act like Malcolm. And when a white man doesn't react to them like he did Malcolm, niggas want to act violently. Niggas act so cool and slick, causing white people to say, what makes them niggas act like that? Niggas act like you ain't never seen nobody act before. But when it comes to acting out revolution, niggas say, I can't dig them action. Niggas are scared of revolution.
I'm not an integrationist, never could be. I couldn't integrate with my enemy, and I know who my enemy is.
Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas talk about getting high and riding around in L's. Niggas should get high and ride to hell. Niggas talk about pimping, pimping that, pimping what? Pimping yours, pimping mine. Just to be pimping is a hell of a line. Niggas are very untogether people. Niggas are players. Niggas are players, are players. Niggas play football, baseball, and basketball while the white man is cutting off their balls. Niggas tell you they're ready to be liberated, but when you say, let's go take our liberation, niggas reply, I was just playing. Niggas are playing with revolution and losing. Niggas are scared of revolution.
We don't want to have anything to do with any race of dog, two-legged dog, that will stick four-legged dogs on innocent, harmless, women, children, and babies.
Niggas are lovers, are lovers, are lovers. Niggas love to hear Malcolm rap, but they didn't love Malcolm. Niggas love everything but themselves. But I'm a lover too. Yep, I'm a lover too. I love niggas, I love niggas, I love niggas. Because niggas are me, and I should only love that which is me. I love to see niggas go through changes, love to see niggas act, love to see niggas make them plays and shoot the shit. But there's one thing about niggas I do not love,
Niggers are scared of revolution.
We declare our rank on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Hey, this is Jonathan Colton, and you're listening to a podcast released under a Creative Commons license. CC, baby. Check it out.
Radio Insurgente, la voz de los sin voz.
Vamos, 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 vamos adelante, para que salgamos en la lucha avante. Porque nuestra patria grita y necesita de todo el esfuerzo de los zapatistas.
Transmitiendo desde algún lugar de las montañas del sureste mexicano, en la frecuencia 99.7 en FM.
Would you like to hear the lie that judges tell jurors every day?
Listen up. This matters. I'm Lewis Black, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
In a criminal case, the judge instructs the jury, you decide the facts, but you jurors must apply to those facts the law as I explain it. And if the prosecution has proven the defendant's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt, then you must return a verdict of guilty. The problem with this instruction? It's not true. It's not true at all. And the judge well knows that, but most jurors don't. Jury nullification, the right of jurors to say no, to just say no to a prosecution, was central to the Bill of Rights. Indeed, Thomas Jefferson famously believed that jurors' right to nullify was central to democracy. Writing in the Champion magazine recently, criminal defense attorney Patrick Barone cautions that care must be taken when considering nullification because juries can use that authority to enhance and augment the power of the elite rather than to limit it. But, Barone continues, jury nullification can and should be a critical limitation on legislatures bent on promulgating and judges bent on enforcing ever more overreaching criminal laws. The take-home lesson here, criminal juries should know of their right to nullify because that power can constitute liberty's last defense.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the American Civil Liberties Union because freedom can't defend itself.
This is FSN reporter MJ Del Valle in Tbilisi, Georgia. Free Speech Radio News has been an essential outlet for my stories from the Caucasus region, including in-depth looks at the recent Armenian presidential election, the creative ways protesters in Azerbaijan are using to fight for freedom of expression, and labor struggles in the Republic of Georgia. But FSRN, along with the voices of people struggling for dignity, equality, and human rights, could be silenced. Find out how can you support independent grassroots journalists at fsrn.org.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
And the Democrats are throwing the election away. For what? An inadequate black male who would not have been running had it not been a white woman that was running for president. I'm no second-class citizen. And goddamn the Democrat.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to this, the first episode of the third series Navarra, broadcast live on Resonance 104.4 FM London. My name's Aaron Peters, and as ever, I'm joined by Luminary and Lothario, the eighth moon of Saturn, James Butler, at Pierce Penalis. Hi, James.
Hi.
Over the summer, James had the good sense and the intelligence to write an exceptionally interesting interview that's now available on NavarraMedia.com. So catch that if you can. What's the name of the interview, James?
It's an interview with the Balfour Tower evictee.
Yeah, there you go. It's there.
It's there.
It's,
read it.
It's worth reading. Lots of people read it already. Her voice. She's extraordinary. I will be catching up with her actually at the end of this coming week, so there will be an update coming on her current situation. Needless to say, of course, Tower Hamlets Council have continued to be absolutely awful. And as with many people, her housing situation is one that's absolutely dire. And it's simply an example of something that's going on across the capital and across the country.
Mm, a germane topic which we hope to cover as the series progresses. All of the previous shows are also available at navarromedia.com. And you may, of course, listening to this show as a podcast. Hello. For those unaware of this possibility, you can find all of the podcasts for previous shows at podcast.navarromedia.com. We're also on Facebook and Tumblr, Navarro Media, and on Twitter, at Navarro Media. And you can, of course, follow today's discussion, as ever, on the hashtag Navarro FM. Some quick housekeeping. I've got the feather duster and the penny out. Launch of Navarro TV. It is happening. It's not a giant troll. We will be discussing with some friends, some very worthy comrades, esteemed comrades, next week about the location of a studio, of which we cannot really speak too much, but it is happening. So we look forward to that at some point in autumn, winter 2013. And some of Navarro Texts is now available as ebooks, right?
Mm-hmm.
Including something you wrote on columnism.
Yes.
Something I've written on Workfare, and that's actually on Amazon. So find that if you can. If you go on Amazon, check out Weaponizing Workfare. So, today's show, the major point of interest, of course, we're going to be discussing fascism, anti-fascism, and the state. The show is essentially generated as a response to this EDL demo in Tower Hamlets that is tomorrow. Maybe you can tell the listeners a little bit about that, James, a little bit about the work of South London anti-fascists and so on.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so we have forthcoming tomorrow, as I'm sure most people listening to this know, a declaration of intent by the EDL to march through Tower Hamlets. This has been sort of a destination point for them and for various incarnations of racist and fascist past. I mean, historically, of course, the National Front used to do their paper sales at the bottom of Brick Lane. So this area, which has been a historic area for combat between fascists and anti-fascists, includes Cable Street, where I'm sure everyone listening to this knows about the Battle of Cable Street, but if you don't, it's well worth looking up. Historically a Jewish area and now a Bangladeshi area. The EDL's target, as it ever is, are the mosques in the area, and the intention, of course, to march on. And this is the expression, of course, they use, march on in this sort of militarized form, Tower Hamlets. So the Anti-Fascist Network, which is a network of anti-fascist organizers across the UK, with many in London, is organizing to prevent that. There's a call out asking people to be present at Altab Ali Park at 11 a.m. Mm-hmm. tomorrow. I would implore everybody to get out there and get involved in that. It's really quite important.
Where are details of this online?
Details of this online will be available on various websites. If you Google London anti-fascists, it's up on there. South London anti-fascists have the details up on their website as well, which is slaf.org.uk. And there are various sort of Facebook events and linked Facebook events about that. You can also follow an account tweeting the events of tomorrow, which is TH Stop EDL, which is an account run by the Anti-Fascist Network. So lots of options there. Get on it, get involved. It's really, really important. One of the things we'll be talking about today is the historical importance of street mobilization to stop fascists. It's one of the things that, various myrmidons of the Nazi Party reflected sort of later on once they'd come to power, which is the one way to have stopped that would have been to smash their meetings early on to organize and physically confront these people. And of course, one of the things that we'll talk about is the way in which these things have changed. Of course, we are not in the same sort of historical moment as sort of the Weimar Republic, but there are commonalities there, and there is of course a continuity in terms of fascist organizing over time. So yeah, get out tomorrow, and obviously our solidarity goes out to everybody who's actively out on the streets stopping racists and fascists.
So where do you want to start? I mean, you forwarded four really great, interesting, provocative articles to me, which will be posted along with this with this show later on the website. Where do you want to start?
Well, I guess one of the places to start here is to talk about an article written by Gilles Dauvet, which is the pen name of a French left communist writer. It's called Fascism/Anti-Fascism, I think, something like that. It's an interesting piece, particularly because it sort of attempts to examine the historical flaws within anti-fascist organizing, but also within sort of anti-fascist conceptions of how fascism came to strength and how to go about combating it. Now, I must say, at this juncture, there are various parts of Dauvet's article that I disagree with. I think they're sort of insufficient or fall prey to a kind of a lot of those problematic modes of left communist sort of theorizing, chin stroking, this sort of notion of a kind of static and determinate form of economic interaction, the notion which I find, which is oddly shared between quite a lot of left communists and various rather less salubrious movements, which is the notion that the working class en masse is mostly a bunch of sort of undifferentiated, unintelligent, incapable of action rather than reaction. So the notion in Dauvet and the notion in a lot of this stuff is always that so it's capital that always moves, that is always on the front foot, and it's the class that's always on the back foot and reactive. Now, we've discussed, I think, many times in the past, the legacy of sort of what has been called the Copernican inversion, that kind of theoretical work that accompanied the autonomist movement in Italy, which is to say that actually this is not always necessarily the case, and in fact very often it's the other way around, and capital finds itself responding to the organisation and movement of the class itself. That to one side, and I don't want to get sort of trapped in polemic against sort of vast and abstruse left communist texts. There's some stuff in the Dauvet article which is worth addressing. But one of the things I sort of just wanted to dwell on first is that I had running through my head this morning, sort of rereading this piece, that sentence from Benjamin's thesis on the philosophy of history. It's in the sixth thesis, and it runs: "The only writer of history with the gift of setting alight the sparks of hope in the past is the one who is convinced of this, that not even the dead will be safe from the enemy if he is victorious, and he has not ceased to be victorious." So that's something I would want to sort of have hovering over us today, which is the notion that even in death, and even the facts of our history past, there is not such a thing as a kind of a static victory in this sense, and it's like particularly obvious in terms of sort of racist and fascist mobilization that the dead themselves are mobilized and sort of reinscribed in these various ways. But yeah, I mean, so to have that sort of hanging over us is, I think, worthwhile. And given that the 20th century is ringed and wreathed with the dead, including Benjamin himself, as in relation to this movement, the historical existence of fascism. That's worth having that. Anyway, one of the things that Dauvet says, which I think is worth dwelling on, is the question of, like, and particularly when he's writing, which is a couple of decades ago now, that matter of verbal inflation. So fascism coming to mean a generalized and broad catch-all terms for sort of nasty things, bad things.
The headmaster's setting you some mathematics.
So I think obviously, like, this is quite dangerous. Fascism names a particular thing, but one of the things that becomes obvious when examining sort of the history of fascism is that it's also very hard often to pin that down. There's a series of kind of what Umberto Eco has called kind of genetic resemblances between strains of fascism, but specific features are not necessarily shared between them, or that those features are in forms of different emphasis among them. So the Spanish Falangists and Mussolini's fascists have really extraordinary differences while also sitting on this same continuum. So one of the things to dwell on is the question of like how that works, how, why that is the case, why there are these weird and different instantiations, whether that catch-all term is necessarily useful for us, and whether that catch-all term applies to things now, because one of the questions that remains active in terms of conceptualizing what we're doing, it's less an organizational question than it is a theoretical one, and as always, my emphasis, particularly in terms of anti-fascism, is that practical activity has got to sort of exceed our habit of sort of sitting and chin-stroking. But the question of whether, say, the EDL is fascist, per se, is worth asking. Now, there's a material fact here, which is that there is a physical, biological and material continuity between members of the EDL and historic racist and fascist organisations like the BNP, like the National Front.
Even the level of personnel, right?
Yeah. And I mean, this is a personal thing.
Yeah.
You know, there are people involved in the BNP who have been long-term involved in sort of the fascist music, so-called underground music network, Blood and Honour. Mm. So these connections absolutely exist. So in a very obvious sense, there is that continuity there. But why is it that the EDL appears as a sort of less fascist or less overtly fascist movement? And maybe we need to ask whether the markers of fascism themselves have changed. What we're looking for, the kind of signifiers here, have changed, and why that's the case.
Mm. I mean, I'm going to give you a great quote by Amadeo Bordiga, which I profoundly disagree with here, and that's from the Dorvay essay. It says, "Fascism steals from the proletariat its secret, organisation. Liberalism is all ideology with no organisation. Fascism is all organisation with no ideology." So if we, and I mean a lot of my own work focuses on this in particular, we live in a period where organisations, how we organise, the nature of collective action, because it's being mediated by a whole new set of technologies, is really up for grabs and it's looking very different to how it may have looked even a half a century ago, right? And the EDL is a case in point. So, Bordiga's claim here, fascism is all organisation, no ideology. What does that mean for an organisational form like the EDL, which doesn't have a full-time, you know, paid, subs-paying, card-carrying membership? It has more likes on Facebook than, you know, the Conservative and UKIP parties have members. But what does that translate to? It doesn't really have a full-time secretariat exercising kind of command and control over a membership, a quiescent membership. Really interesting questions. And for me, that Bordiga claim there, I mean, if it was intellectually bankrupt when he wrote it, it's certainly intellectually bankrupt now. So a question, fascist ideology, what is it? I've got a nice quote, great quote, from a guy from Anti-Fascist Action, and he says, "Fascism, the world over, is essentially a middle-class ideology based on nationalism, capitalism, obedience, and snobbery." And I think that sums it up perfectly. Absolutely perfectly, James.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. I mean, there's one of the things that's really sort of worthwhile emphasising here, which is that there's a habit among particularly sort of rather poorly informed journalists to speak of fascism as a movement of the working class. It's actually quite different to that. It's in many senses often a cross-class movement, but Tommy Robinson here. Tommy Robinson is a business owner, he's a landlord. Like this guy...
Which name should we use? Paul Harris? Stephen Yaxley Lennon? I mean, he's got four names.
I mean,
I think it's Paul Harris.
Dovey recognises this, of course. I mean, he says like there are various sort of hallmarks of fascism, saying, so for instance, it's a movement that's born in the streets.
Yeah.
It's one that preaches order but stirs up disorder, mm-hmm. which I think is an interesting tension.
Mm-hmm.
But the third sort of hallmark he uses is to say that it's a movement of the obsolete middle class, ending in their sort of more or less violent destruction. and that tendency is itself quite interesting. The fourth characteristic here is one that sort of Dovey mentions, but it's also been the mainstay of one of the current sort of academic researchers on fascism, which is Roger Griffin, mm-hmm. no relationship to Nick. So Dovey talks about this in terms of like the regeneration of the traditional state. Griffin suggests that like one of the like chief hallmarks of fascism is what he calls a palingenetic myth, a central mythology about sort of the rebirth, the renaissance, the reconstruction of the state, the traditional state, in a form that often never existed, right? So it's like deeply imbricated with all this sort of mythology. One of the things that's interesting to me about say the EDL as opposed to something like the BNP or the National Front is exactly what that mythos is. And one of the things I think we'll come on to talk about is the way in which contemporary fascism is a fascism that exists in the guise of anti-fascism. And I mean by that, I mean, that's kind of an abstruse phrase, but what I mean is that you'll see these people, you'll see the EDL in particular, make the argument that they are the inheritors of that great generation that fought against totalitarianism and fascism and all of these things. So that they're sort of the real inheritors. And this is sort of in its sort of lowest common denominator form comes out when people, you know, they say, oh, well, who's the real fascist here? Is it us who are racists or you who are trying to stop us being racist with physical confrontation? There's this thing here. One of the things I think to take away from the Dovet essay, and it's as much a plangent critique now as it was then of a liberal anti-fascism, and of course Dovet collapses all terms into this, but I think it remains a strong critique of liberal anti-fascism, which is to say that, look, it's the thing that goes unspoken within fascism, which is within anti-fascism, sorry, which is this a defense of the so-called democratic state, mm-hmm. right? An uncritical defense mm-hmm. of it. Dovet says, and says rightly, that the state is an instrument of class domination. So opposing this to fascism is not a useful thing for us. The democratic state itself is against class struggle, of course. I mean, it's as much a class collaborationist project as fascism itself is. Mm-hmm. So the direction of this kind of liberal anti-fascism is towards a strong state rather than communism, which is, of course, Dovet's critique of it. Mm-hmm. So the argument that he's making, in a sense, is one that can be applied to those people, as we saw various people this morning cheering for or cheering on a state ban of the EDL march. These people include George Galloway, Lee Jasper, all the various sort of... what's the word I can use here? Probably none that's broadcastable. The various luminaries of this particular tradition. This is a toxic and stupid move. I guess that's not entirely surprising. The other point of Dovet's essay that I think is important is where he suggests that sort of fascism is not a weapon. In particular, its form as dictatorship is not a weapon used by capital, but a tendency of capital itself when it's attempting to deal with various crises. As I've said, like, the problem, I think, with a lot of Dovet's essay is like it's his refusal to acknowledge that the class is capable of movement itself, nor indeed like the recognition that the anti-fascist movement itself is deeply striated in this sense. But he's correct to say that, you know, as much now as then, a lot of nominally anti-fascist organisations tell us that we'll fight fascism by reaching the lowest common denominator, possibly voting Labour, and turning up and sort of all singing Kumbaya together. Mm-hmm. This obviously is nonsense. One of the things that's important to say here is that, the democratic state is not a friend to a revolutionary movement, obviously. But the sort of vein of sort of pro-patriotic rhetoric that runs through this notion that fascism is bad because it's not in keeping with the values of our country, that is not British. Mm. This is a very toxic and dangerous kind of progressive racism, one that Billy Bragg, for instance, is fond of. Mm. And I think it should be named as such. It should be named as a progressive racism, and it should be combated and called out against this. So that's worth keeping and worth talking about.
Several points. Well, the first one's a quick one. It's a slight deviation with regards to this idea of Britishness and so on. A number 10 aid discussing some of the measures being discussed at the G20. So that it's going to be a very British kind of agenda on trade and tax. So now clamping down on tax avoidance is very British, inverted commas. This is astonishing. Late 2010, Philip Green was invited to advise the Prime Minister and the Cabinet how to make cost savings with regards to government procurement, right? Within the space of 3 years, because of antagonism from the bottom up, very, very effective movements, arguments that have shaped discourse, that have framed agendas, you've now got British officials, civil servants, at the level of the G20 saying that clamping down on tax avoidance is very British. This is abysmal, shambolic, bizarre, but also hilarious. I mean, this is just absolutely hilarious. The next thing you're going to hear Sundar Kotwala at British Futures talk about tax avoidance and how, you know, British UKAM got, oh, because when things are successful, when they resonate, when they're germane, when they really, really, really shape and explicitly articulate what people are thinking and feeling very deeply and passionately, power has to subsume them, has to recuperate them, and has to essentially admonish and castrate them at the same time as well, right? Second point, the role, and this is why I love Dove. He's very, very good on empirical examples about these arguments, right? So he makes some pretty outrageous claims, right? Some of them are right, some of them are wrong. But he always offers empirical examples. There's another essay he writes, When Insurrections Die. He does the exact same thing there. In this one, he talks about the role of the Spanish and the Italian left and their collaboration with fascist organising before they kind of ascended, before they took power, before they completely destroyed them. He talks about, likewise, the weakness of Allende and cross-class alliances in Chile, previous to the rise of the generals. He talks about how fascism and liberal democracy, and this is something you just touched upon, how flexible these two things are, right? So when needs be, liberal democracy can lurch to fascism, and likewise, that counter-tendency of fascism going back towards liberal democracy, we see this with Marshal Badoglio in Italy, the revolution of 43-44, the post-war Italian Christian Democrats are fascists. The Christian Democrat Party, which is, for much of the post-war period, the single most powerful political actor in Italian public life, was a fascist organisation. You know, people talk about neo-fascists in Italy. The Christian Democrats were fascists. They were fascists for a new context, and they understood that to retain and extend their interests, they had to behave in particular ways, but these were fascists. These were people literally, you know, saluting Mussolini, you know, in the fora of fascist Italy before 1943. This is not just a kind of, oh, you know, they intellectually resemble them, they say something a bit bad at dinner. These were actual fascists. So that flexibility, I think, is something that Dove is really, really, really good on. At the same time, I think he's also, I mean, this thing with Pinochet and the German SDP. It's the SDP that killed Rosa Luxemburg, you know. Which, incidentally, a century later, the SDP, by the way, is the Social Democrat Party, SPD in German. They're the ones that killed Rosa Luxemburg. They're the ones that smashed the revolution of 1919, the Spartacist uprising. Yet they're the ones building the statue for Luxemburg a century later. Yet they're the ones, in 2002, who begin Agenda 2016, which is the most efficient, effective policy of wage repression the European Union's yet to see. German real wages have been absolutely flat for 10 years. I spoke at a conference in May in Copenhagen, former head of the Danish Central Bank, and he had a graph. He said, European unit labour costs 100, German unit labour costs 100, Danish labour costs 100, right, in 2000. Germany's gone down 5%, EU average stayed flat, Denmark's gone up. And you know, all these Keynesian social democrat sort of students, they go, what does this mean? He goes, what does it mean? It means we've got to reduce wages by 10%, simple as that, which is huge. We'll see a major decline in living standards in Denmark, as is the case for the whole of the European Union. The largest labour market, Germany, has bolted. It's left the stable, and the rest of Europe's got to follow. And that's what we're now seeing. Nobody's talking about it in southern Europe. This was overseen by an SDP government. These people will never be effective in combating fascism. They are the most important, eminent actors in reorganising capitalism, which is what I think Dove is so clear and keen to point out, James.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. This is one of the things that I think is really important, because it plays into this sort of rather dangerous sort of political strategy view of history, which is that, and it's sort of favoured among some communists of various stripes, which is the notion that fascism was necessary to suppress the strength of the workers' movement. It was necessary to smash, you know, this, that, or the other. In fact, the Social Democrats had pretty much effectively done that already. The repressive apparatus of fascism was already greeting a movement that had been rather thoroughly defanged and declawed. And that's something that perhaps it is worth bearing in mind. But I think one of the things that is also important to talk about is to move on from the Dove thing a bit and talk, I guess, a little about Ishai Lander's book, which is called The Apprentice's Sorcerer, which is a much needed actually intervention into studies of fascism, because Lander's argument is essentially that historically, or in terms of the development of the discipline, ways of conceptualizing or understanding fascism, where it comes from, what it is, how it has worked, how it worked historically, have been, this kind of, acceptance of its, it goes through various stages, but, has taken on this notion that, fascism and communism were both kind of what Lander calls frères ennemis, brothers in enmity, in that they shared certain sort of genetic traits, which were anti-democratic, against representation, wanted to attack the bourgeois state as it existed, had deep and abiding suspicions of democracy. And then in particular, this tends to go even further. So sometimes it's advocated that, socialism and fascism are in some sort of dialectical relationship. But sometimes it goes even further. And there has been, historically, a useful corrective to sort of understandings of fascism, to say that, look, there are certain aspects of the roots of fascism which have deep commonalities with sort of leftist demands. They come from a sort of socialist tradition. This comes with sort of saying, like, let's take fascists at their word. So why do they call themselves very often socialists? Well, Lander says actually quite correctly that very often they have like a great degree of hesitancy about this word and dislike it intensely. In fact, Oswald Spengler says something like, words don't matter really, it doesn't. So there's that on the one hand, and then there's this question of sort of the subsumption of all sort of so-called non-democratic movements or popular movements into the vector of totalitarianism. And Hannah Arendt bears, of course, some responsibility for this, as do people who draw on her. There are many ways in which I like Arendt, but this notion of totalitarianism is, I think, one that's rather underexamined. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the frame here. Lander sort of suggests and spends the entire book sort of fleshing out this argument, and it's one that's worth picking up because it's really, really strong on this, that actually fascism is a capitalist movement, but that in a sense is obvious. He suggests, however, that fascism is generated by the tensions within liberalism itself, and this is where, of course, the book's title comes from, The Apprentice's Sorcerer. So it's a question of that sort of historical demand of liberalism, which comes from the bourgeois in the 18th century, which is to say that we want representative government, and this is combined with a kind of economic liberalism, but that political liberalism then gets extended when you have lower classes demanding enfranchisement, right? This then becomes a problem. So you have sort of the kind of generation of these sort of liberals, what in many ways are interesting class of people, and Lander calls them anti-liberal liberals, in that they support the economic arguments of liberalism, that the arguments of Locke, for instance, about sort of liberalism as a bulwark for capitalism, or Pareto, who attacks liberalism from a capitalist standpoint. Pareto, incidentally, a huge influence on Mussolini. Mm-hmm. So there's this genealogy here, which is quite important. Hitler's attack on the Republic, the Weimar Republic, was in many ways to do with or couched in these terms of like interference with the economy. So this is like a launching pad for capitalism. So Lander suggests that, in fact, it's not a third way between sort of capitalism and communism, nor is it a kind of frère ennemi of communism or socialism, but actually that it descends from or is generated by those contradictions within liberalism itself. And he draws on various people to make this point. Carlyle is one of them. George Sorrell, who is often drawn on. He talks about the general strike a bit, Sorrell, and therefore is very interested in, people find him interesting. But actually, I think Lander is right to say this, that Sorrell's enemy is a weak capitalism, and it plays into that sort of historical argument about the decadence of the economy and of culture at the time, all of which is sort of, one one of those historical roots of fascism, particularly in Germany. He tackles various myths, you know, this notion is, of fascism as collectivism. There's certainly a rhetoric of that there, but the way fascism operates, of course, is to do with the kind of great man theory of history, involves sort of a, you know, the identity essentially of a state with a leader, but then also with a race. There's this question of like whether fascism is the tyranny of a majority. Well, actually, I mean, you know, there is this tradition in liberalism, say in Benedetto Croce, which is all to do with the defense of a propertied class. Lando, of course, draws on Ludwig von Mises here, who says, look, it will be necessary to install a dictatorship to defend liberalism. So this is, I mean, this is all, you know, quite important and quite interesting and worth sort of exploring a bit. But it does, it presents us with something that I think we have to make clear, which is that fascism and fascist movements have very, very little to do with the rhetoric in which they sometimes cloak themselves. So that rhetoric of collectivism, or the rhetoric of, unexpressed grievances of the class, in fact, have very, very little to do with what's actually going on there. This is, you know, in some ways, you know, important to underline, because it's often conceived of that fascism is, or has historically been, like a nationalistic attack on liberal cosmopolitanism. And you know, in a sense here, the historical nation state at a time when this was happening was the guarantor of mass rights. So you have people sort of like, you know, having the nation state as a guarantor of their various rights. And that's difficult. That's difficult for fascists. In Germany, however, it seems quite obvious that the nation state is a platform for capitalist expansion. And this, of course, like, so this argument to do with like fascism's roots within liberalism, within those tensions and paradoxes of liberalism itself, suggest a couple of things. One is that contra Dover, fascism is always going to be a potential vector for capitalist expansion, particularly in moments of crisis. That, I think, is really important and something to be aware of. The other thing here is that we then have to reconceptualize the genocide of the Second World War, the genocide of the Nazi Party, in terms not only racist, not only anti-Semitic, but also deeply based in this notion of sort of capitalist expansion. So, you know, this new genealogy is difficult and disturbing, and this is sort of a kind of where that myth of regeneration really comes in. So you get the regeneration of a nation state via the expungement of useless classes, or parasitic or poisonous or dangerous classes. But it's also, the argument here is that, or the ideology here is something to do with rebirthing the state as an entity of class harmony and contentment, for the advancement of production. So the notion is that you expunge all those useless classes, or those dangerous classes, or those toxic classes, and then you'll have people who are happy in their class positions. Let's never forget that this is one of the great sort of arguments of fascists historically, is that what we want is not a classless state. And this is again a point where it's, you know, you can say that there is no similarity between communism and fascism in this case, because of this. But it also tells us a lot about the range of victims here. So, you know, it's not just Jews, but it's also sort of so-called useless classes, the disabled, the ill, and those who are antagonists to capitalist production. So communists, anarchists, those who...
just don't like work.
Yeah, those who, well, I mean, indeed. So the point here to say is that rather than historical fascism being history's or the democratic state's monstrous other, it's a particular capitalist strategy. It's a particular vector of capitalist production or expansion. Is this unsettling? Yes, I think it is. It is unsettling to think of it in this way. It's unsettling precisely because we are no longer estranged from it. It's one of the things that so-called fascist studies has done over the last few decades, is actually delimit and contain fascism as very often a kind of historical aberration or something that evolved from a very unique set of circumstances that will never return again. This is not the case. And it's much more unsettling to think of it, to think of, you know, these things as being produced by something that continues to this day. It it's worrying and difficult to think of it as that. It's worrying and difficult to think of fascism as what it is, which is, to my mind, capitalism militant.
Mm. I mean, to quickly go back to that Dauvet article, and it's a point that you've very clearly pointed out there, is that, you know, one should see fascism as kind of emergency management for the capitalist mode of production, right? So, during what's sometimes called the sort of Belle Epoque, the 1890s to the First World War, liberal nationalist government does the job, actually, even in the face of really increasingly strong and antagonistic labour, organised primarily along the anarcho-syndicalist model in much of North America and Europe. It works. And then we have the First World War. We have a huge shock to the global economic architecture after the Great Depression. And it's then within that context that in order for national capitals to reorganize and restructure themselves, adapt to the new environment, that task cannot be overseen, cannot be administrated by the previous actors that were sufficient, right? So we're talking about the Italian Liberal Party. We're talking about the Weimar Republic. When that happens, they then give way to, obviously, fascism in Spain and Germany. One interesting point that's made with Dauvet is that this only happens in those countries where there is not a sufficiently sophisticated governance architecture, right? So in the UK and the US, you don't see the rise of fascism. And that's not because kind of genetically or nationally we're disposed to an anti-fascism, right? Or kind of, you know, we have these kind of these liberal norms kind of imbued within our DNA, you know, this ethical sediment within our national psyche. Anything but that. What instead he points out, and I think this is correct, is that because Germany and Italy were very late to the game of national unification, we're talking the 1870s, they didn't have sufficiently strong, sophisticated class organizations to reorganize for the new architecture, right? The new reality, my apologies. So, what the Nazi Party do in the 1930s with regards to reorganizing the German labor market, with regards to essentially destroying the German middle class, which is what they do, in its old understanding of kind of the petty bourgeoisie, what's the equivalent in this country? Well, we've talked on this show a number of times about the role of the TUC in wage repression. Wages in the 1930s in this country were more effectively repressed than anywhere else in Europe. That's not because they were particularly sort of nasty people. They were just much, much better at doing their job as an organisation than their equivalents elsewhere on the continent. And that pressure valve in 1926 with the general strike wasn't there in Italy and Germany. It was here in the UK, so maybe that's something we can talk about.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I wanted to come on to say is to really tackle this notion, this myth of British exceptionalism, and which I argue will be the myth, or is the myth, around which a sort of resurgent British fascism is founded. So then this idea that a sort of anti-fascist fascism, right, a fascism that does not name itself as such yet clothes itself in the garb of anti-fascism, sort of the shiny button police officer, the British lion, a democracy against the other, mm-hmm. In a sense. So you have Lord Halifax in 1937 saying, you know, fascism is the bulwark of the West against Bolshevism. You have the great icon of the EDL and the great icon of, in fact, every reactionary from the Labour Party rightwards, further rightwards, I should probably say, about the Labour Party these days, or indeed all days. So Churchill, fascism has rendered a service to the whole world. Hereafter, no great nation will be unprovided with an ultimate means of protection against the cancerous growth of Bolshevism. Churchill on Mussolini, the greatest lawgiver among living men. Fascism is a necessary antidote to the Russian poison. Worth noting here, of course, that actually in the development of fascism, and particularly when it becomes an electoral project during the middle of the 20th century, in those countries, and I'm thinking now of say Germany or of Italy, in those countries where it is an electoral project, the vote transfers came not from the left. They didn't come. The left vote in those countries was largely undiminished and relatively static over those periods. The vote transfer came from liberals, the liberal vote into the fascist vote. And that's worth underlining. That's worth making sure that's clear. One more line from Churchill, I think, because I think this is worth doing. It's worth recording these things.
And this is 1937.
1937.
This is a year after the Munich Agreement.
1937.
So this whole myth about him sort of being against the appeasers is complete nonsense. Go on.
One may dislike Hitler's system, yet admire his patriotic achievement. If our country were defeated, I hope we should find a champion as indomitable to restore our courage and lead us back to our place among the nations. Look, I mean, this is a thing that is worth really, really making clear. You know, fascism only worries these people insofar as it becomes sort of directly threatening to them. In itself, it's not a, you know, it's not something that worries them. I mean, the question of Czechoslovakia is an interesting one. Look, I mean, you know, largely the notion that Czechoslovakia would be a bad thing to have been annexed by the German state, by the Nazi state, is historically tendentious. There were many, many people among the policy establishment, particularly in Britain, who thought that this would be a great idea. It gives them an eastern corridor with which to attack the communists. This would be fantastic. So that's less of worry. Look, the triumph of fascism in Spain didn't trouble Chamberlain at all. Mm. So again, like this is really worth making clear. There's one thing I wanted to read from Evelyn Waugh, which I think connects that question about the general strike as well, and shows actually how sort of imbricated sort of either sort of proto-fascist or crypto-fascist ideas were among not only the policy establishment but the aristocracy, among the intelligentsia, among artists within Britain itself. And in fact, one might reflect that one of the reasons that Mosley's BUF was not successful is that it failed to grasp what fascism was actually doing on the continent and was merely a sort of mimetic activity, so it failed to adapt to what it was attempting to do. Anyway, this from Evelyn Waugh, which I think is worth listening to. Fascism is a growth of certain peculiar soils. Principally, it needs two things: a frightened middle class who see themselves in danger of extinction in a proletarian state, and some indignant patriots who believe that their country, through internal dissension, is becoming bullied by the rest of the world. In England, we had something like a fascist movement in 1926, when the middle classes broke the general strike. Mm-hmm. We have a middle class that is uniquely apt for strenuous physical adventures, amenable to discipline, bursting with esprit de corps, and a great fund of patriotism. It is quite certain that England would become fascist before it became communist. It is quite likely to become neither. One of the things that's interesting here, of course, is sort of Waugh's recognition in a period in which fascism did not have the same sort of pejorative and taboo value it does these days, that the movement against the general strike in 1926 was quite fascist in tone, in terms of the middle class protecting its own interests. And again, this is one of those arguments about class which I think has to be made about fascism. The other thing here, I think, is that now, moving from that, and moving from obviously something to which Waugh is sympathetic, and Waugh is quoted elsewhere as saying that he would certainly be a fascist before he was a communist, is to say that sort of mythos, that notion of the kind of great, hardy, and peculiarly sort of physically active and doughty British middle class, is something that, I mean, again, continues today with our various sort of myths of sort of stiff upper lip and sort of British tolerance and no nonsense and, you know, all this sort of absolute. No, yeah, was looking for a word there. So I mean, there is this sort of bias within sort of historical conceptions in terms of sort of this presupposition of the democratic commitment of British leaders. But look, England never faced the crisis that Germany did. England never lost a world war in the way that Germany did. It never faced the collapse of its regime. It never faced, you know, this sort of complete ripping away that happened after the First World War. Had that happened in England, do we think that we would be, you know, we would be so confident in the leadership's nominal sort of democratic commitment? And this is a thing to return to, I think, when we're talking about these movements today, right? Which is that look, I mean, you know, the crisis is different, it's shaped differently, there hasn't been a catastrophic war in the same sense. But if you're looking, you know, at what's going on today, we're really going to have to think about this and think about sort of the fragility of representative democracy, of bourgeois democracy as it stands. It is fragile, it is a fragile thing, and it's fragile partly because the people who nominally lead it are venal, are corrupt, and are very happy to make alliances with fascist movements or pander to them and be directed by them if that seems necessary. It was the story with fascists historically. It's the story with fascists and fascist movements now.
Another point, you're saying if we'd lost the you know, one of the world wars, we'd have had a similar situation. We also had an empire. The UK had, Britain had an empire, which meant that you had these huge markets which could help with issues of overproduction. You could export your surplus population, as we did, to several continents. So you could, Britain, could do a number of things, which really undermine the possibility of not only antagonistic and resistant Labour subjects, but also actually meant different kinds of possibilities for capitalists. I want to ask you a question, because I think we kind of agree that fascism is a particular vector, like you've said, that's necessary within certain conditions, within a certain context, where capitalism has to reorganise itself. So what is the role of the European Union, right now, in reorganising national capitals? Because if we think about, I mean, we talk about the crises, ours is a time of a number of crises. If we're going to focus specifically on the European Union, you've got sovereign debt crises in Greece, Portugal, Spain, Cyprus, Italy, France. That's going to take several years, but they really are on a par with the countries which everybody knows are completely stuffed. You've got a really, really, really interesting thing going on here, right? Which is the removal of national sovereignty. It's the demise of national middle classes. In certain countries, they're even arbitrarily taking people's savings, as was the case in Cyprus. That's going to happen in more and more countries within the European Union, quite plausibly. So what are your thoughts on that with regards to fascism and anti-fascist organising? Because this idea of fascism as a reorganising of national capitals in order to make them re-competitive. Right now, European sovereign states, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, simply cannot compete with China, with India, Brazil, Indonesia. So the formation of a single European labour market, a single market for goods and services, a single currency, a single tax base, a single army, will be utterly, utterly necessary. So what happens in that context?
Well, I mean, this is a hard one to answer, and I worry about entering purely speculative territory, of course, with this stuff. But
it seems to be undermining what is a huge crisis of sovereignty and
labour
unrest in the south.
Absolutely. I mean, of course, the interesting ones that here is, of course, the Golden Dawn in Greece, mm-hmm. Which is, you know, a classical fascist movement in many senses. And in fact, I think they, you know, it's less the activity of the Golden Dawn itself, which again, you know, I think is conceivable in this in the same way that we've talked about a middle class kind of protecting, attempting to protect its own ends. But look, it's less to do with that than the kind of political ground given to these things, right? So, look, I mean, the political reason for the existence of the European Union, of course, is in many ways to see no longer any land war in Europe, and this to be achieved via the mechanisms of trade and mutual kind of self-interest. This doesn't seem to be working, actually. Mm. Right? I mean, that's probably an understatement. But I think it would be extremely difficult for there to arrive a European nationalism or a European tribalism which penetrates across the EU. Now, this is sometimes a hallmark of actually quite a lot of fascist movements. It was, it exists within sort of, say, Anders Breivik's manifesto, right? This notion that there is a particular sort of unity of peoples, genetic, racial, eugenic, whatever. But whether that can be undertaken as a political project, a political project of capture within the European Union as a political entity, no, I don't think so. Any kind of fascist movement will be one that seeks either to renegotiate or simply exit the European Union, because it sees it inescapably as an instrument of political and sort of social control.
I mean, because Euroscepticism, for me, seems to be the great avatar of anything that could be a popular fascism in this country, right?
Absolutely.
And if you look at some of the breakdowns on UKIP voters, their feelings about race and so on, you know, I've got a really interesting, which we'll put on the website after the show. It's a breakdown of BNP and UKIP voters on things like race and so on. If somebody's black, are they less British? Mm-hmm. And actually, UKIP, whilst far in excess of the other parties, about 18% think that somebody's less British because of the colour of their skin. Still abhorrent, but nowhere near the BNP, which is about 44-45%. On Euroscepticism, on the other hand,
you know, 80% say we must leave the European Union. It's only been bad for the economy and so on. So what's the role of Euroscepticism in this, for particularly UKIP and the EDL?
Well, I mean,
what's an avatar for? Is it globalisation?
What, the European Union?
No, Euroscepticism. What's an avatar for?
Because obviously, look, Euroscepticism is simply the notion that you know, it's a poisonous projection, right? Of the notion that there is like some agentive force that is disenfranchising or disempowering or indeed sort of capturing or poisoning the prosperity of these people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think this is actually less interesting than it is to say that, okay, I mean, there is this question of whether racism is completely coterminous with these particular hard right ideologies. But the point here is that the racism has always been a contingent tool of fascism. This is something that most people, academics in this field make very clear, is that although it has come to be the fact that, racism is the hallmark par excellence, of course, of fascist movements, that fascism has, like, multiple other vectors of appeal, which is, racism is not the be-all and end-all of fascism. It is a particular coalition of sort of class interests and the notion of sort of reorganization within one country. I think more interesting to talk about here is whether there would be a possibility of a fascism that isn't based fundamentally in racism. I think that's no longer actually possible. And of course, I mean, look, when these kind of questions are asked, it's not as if they're asked without a social habitus. People know and have been educated to say that if I were to ask you in the middle of the street, unless you are an out and out sort of hardcore racist, do you think being black makes you less British? The habit here is to say no, right? But this notion, it's important to realise, and in fact, against the grain of sort of historical, the tendency of academic studies in this area is to say, look, you cannot take fascists at their word because their word is infinitely malleable. They say this. They say this very clearly, and they say this very obviously historically. What I'm sort of more interested in is the sort of pre-fascist or proto-fascist matrix out of which fascism arises. And this would be a good point for us to move and talk about that last text from AFA, Anti-Fascist Action, which is called Filling the Vacuum, which is very much worth reading. I think it's still an important political document, actually. And this is to say that, look, I mean, I am the first one to absolutely defend the need to physically confront fascists in the street. I will also defend political violence. Mm-hmm. Worth picking up incidentally on this, that the history of AFA, which is Beating the Fascists, which is available at all good bookshops, including Freedom. to say there's an excellent line in it from a member of AFA, which is, I recognise and understand the uses of political violence. It's just the fighting I can't deal with. It's that question, physical violence here not being something to be gloried in, but rather difficult and always stressed. And the habit, of course, of physical violence and physical confrontation becoming the be-all and end-all of a movement. And that's, I think, what that Filling the Vacuum text is trying to combat. And there's a line in it about attempting to avoid being sucked into what becomes sort of just a gang war between fascists and anti-fascists.
Yeah.
And it's really, really important and lays out the need for kind of social organisation in this sense and sort of doing that other work, which has always had lip service paid to it within the anti-fascist movement, but which hasn't, or has sort of misfired or misstarted or has been always actually a lot harder than doing the act of physical confrontation itself, is that long-term organisational work. So, I mean, that's one of the things that I really want to lay down here and say that, look, I mean, one of the things that makes me most hopeful at the moment about sort of anti-fascist organising is that the wave of anti-fascist organising that's greeted the resurgence of fascist movements since Woolwich has been, more focused, I think, than sort of most instances in the past in recognising that this is like a multi-vector approach, right? That simply, combating the symptoms of fascism, simply dealing with these people on the street, this is of absolute importance. There should be, to my mind, no shirking about this, that it has to be done, and it has to be done, physically and in confrontation with these people. And yet we also see the need here for sort of political and class organisation against exactly what happens when these movements spring up, which is that the state moves to capture them and reflect them as sort of, you know, the great desires of the people. So you see this uptick in sort of UKBA, immigration raids. You see a sort of huge rise in simple racist violence by the police. One of the cases I want to mention here is the Hassani Williams case. This was a passenger in a car that 1 week after Woolwich had its tyres shot out by police, its windows smashed.
This was a hard stop.
This was a hard stop taking place in Woolwich in the immediate aftermath of the Lee Rigby murder. You know, these were like two young black men beaten and tasered by the police, subject to racist abuse.
Several times they were tasered?
Yeah. And then had drugs planted on them. You know, one of the brothers had his skull cracked and had to be taken to hospital. They were denied their legal rights. They were denied all sorts of sort of process. So this is what the state does in reaction to the rise of it simply enables racism by the state. So one of the things that I think has been really important is the emergence or re-emergence of an anti-fascist movement that sees its work not simply as the confrontation of fascists in the street, but the destruction of the matrix which allows these movements to exist and allows them to transpire, which is to say that, look, given that this is, as we argue, a movement that is not a working class movement, it should be up to us and it should be within our capacity to organise in this way, to absolutely make to render the terrain absolutely stony, to render it impossible for these movements to put down roots. That should be within our capacity. It should, you know, it should be the work, in fact, of every serious leftist, communist, anarchist to undertake this organization. And it's made me very, very glad that this is taking place in a way that isn't what it has historically been, which is sort of white activists arriving somewhere and going, oh, by the way, did you know racism exists? Well, this is going to be so. Yeah, there's a lot of kind of hopeful stuff going on here, and I think one of the things we can do is kick up some links on the site to the various organisations doing this, and encourage people to get involved. Because of course, the thing to say here is that look, there isn't a fascist party likely to be in government soon. This isn't Nazi Germany. Fascism as a movement has changed and it has altered. It is combined with its street element, but the violence that it undertakes is in one sense sort of limited in its street form, but it works as a political vector to drag everything rightward, to increase sort of the legitimacy of racist violence from the state.
I mean, I personally see contemporary fascism as more of an assemblage, which includes mainstream media actors,
absolutely,
the right wing of the Labour Party, UKIP, the EDL, the BNP, the Conservative Party, various business interests, and I think the media kind of constituent element of that assemblage is very, very, very important, because they put discourses in circulation that when there's a political opportunity like Woolwich or like the riots can just be activated like that, and you have tens, hundreds of thousands of people, which we saw actually with some of the kind of EDL vigilante groups in Eltham was one example after the riots. And I think these discourses are in circulation and they become activated. Very interesting hypothesis by a scholar called Bacar Dieva about sub-activism. I think the EDL is in alliance with these media organisations, a superb example of sub-activism that then becomes activated at the political level. And you know what? The Labour Party doesn't care. If those kind of discourses are in circulation and they can activate them for political gain, they'll do it. That's what, you know, people that seek public office do. They do anything to get office. Right, so I guess we've got 1 minute left. Any final thoughts, James?
My final thoughts of these are simply that I hope that I see everyone who's listening here out on the street on Saturday, 11 a.m, Altab Ali Park in Whitechapel. I hope that this goes some way in sort of informing the historical form in which we're seeing these movements arise.
I won't be seeing you tomorrow because I've got certain bail conditions that don't allow me to be there. However, like James says, it would be excellent if as many of you could come as possible. James, thank you very much.
Cheers.
My name is Aaron Peters. This is Navarra. Find us on navarramedia.com, on Facebook, Twitter and Tumblr at the same name. See you same time, same place next week. Bye.
Missy Elliott. for the Black AIDS Institute.
HIV happens to us more than it does anybody else, which is why we should all get tested, because if we don't step up, then nobody will.
Get informed. Tested, get treated, and get involved. For more information, call the Black AIDS Institute at 213-353-3610. That's 213-353-3610. Or online at www.blackaids.org.
I'm going to stand until I can't stand no more if I have to stand by myself.
The American people are the last people to wake up.
Prisons are becoming an integral part of the U.S. economy.
People of color organize critical thinking, strategic work, and direct action for social, racial, gender, and economic justice.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly last.
People of Color Organize features intersections of race, politics, feminism, movement, class, internationalism, and theory.
This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about all of us.
Visit us online at peopleofcolororganize.com. Follow us on Twitter at POC Organize and Facebook at facebook.com/peopleofcolororganize. You can also find us on Tumblr at peopleofcolor.tumblr.com.
We're organizing against what we term genocide.
दोपहर को कहाँ गई थी?
दोपहर को बाजार गई थी।
बता के नहीं जा सकती थी?
अरे अभी इसकी क्या बताना?
पड़ोसियों से पता चलता है मुझे।
पता चले तो क्या हुआ?
चुप! ये घर मैं चलाता हूँ। मुझसे पूछे बगैर कोई काम नहीं होगा इस घर में। चल चला समझ।
घरेलू हिंसा में बाधा डालकर उसे रोको। बेल बजाओ। घरेलू हिंसा अधिनियम पर जानकारी के लिए bellbajao.org पर लॉग ऑन करें। ब्रेक थ्रू की पहल।
Fuck you, Trump. I'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
Darwin described the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get together.
Yo, what's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying, for Men in Hip Hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about, it shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news flash.
I'm Andrew Westmoreland. I am a journalist. And we just, you know, we go out into the community and we find stories that have national importance. You can follow me on Twitter at @DrewWest_press. And you're listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
The media. This is hell.
Live from Hangover Country, this is Hell, this week's live four-hour show, hosted by America's leading intellectual, is being broadcast from the studios of Chicago Sound Experiment, WNUR 89.3 FM, Evanston, streaming live right now in podcast in its entirety. Shortly after, thisishell.com, as well as broadcast and abbreviated one-hour shows on Chicago's South Side on Lumpen Radio and Radio Free Moscow in Moscow, Idaho. I think that's also on Sunday mornings. Is that right, Alex, that we're still on Sunday mornings in Moscow, Idaho?
Yeah.
Sunday mornings, right?
Yes.
KRFP.
KR, there's an R and an FP.
Yeah. That's why we always
say there's an A there somewhere.
I'm just glad that we always just say it's easy just to say Radio Free Moscow and Lumpen Radio. People should just come up with names instead of these numbers. During this week's Hell, the Migrant Caravan is a Revolution in Organizing that the establishment media just can't wrap its head around. Localization and municipalism sound great, but what happens if your local municipality is full of fascist jerks? Co-ops are awesome as well, but how well do they address a community's larger challenges? Being a black intellectual in a world ruled by white gatekeepers who only want to discuss the tragedy of African-American life, well, that must suck. We'll have a writer argue that debate is stupid and that self-care does not actually care for yourself. Of course, we'll have a moment of truth from Jeff Dorchin, which I'll tell you about in a moment. And I'll explain what makes me America's leading intellectual. And no, it's not my ability to recognize sarcasm. Our first guest, who is returning to This Is Hell for the third time. Hey, just like last week's first guest, Natasha Leonard. Our first guest this week, live from Mexico City, independent journalist and researcher Martha Piskowski. Late last month, Martha...